then to do.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is Austin Roof with KSDP. We have your fish report for the day, June the 10th, 2025. No harvest summaries, but we do have our escapement as well as an update from Chignik. They put out their first Chignik number one update for the year. Let's start now with the Alaska Peninsula Weir Report. 3,420 fish up the Chignik River yesterday for a total of 15,312, making them at their midpoint for their escapement objective. That is far and away the most fish that has escaped since 2018. Of course, 2017, 74,000, 2016, 71,000. We have the Nelson River with high water, so no fish were counted at that weir either. They're at zero fish for the season. Illinois River, 158 for a total 2,200 fish up the Illinois River so far to date. And they're in the midpoint so far, probably the low end, really, of the last 10-year cycle. And the Illinois River had no fish up the weir yesterday for a total of one fish to date. Looking now at the Chignik fishery update number one, they are noting that there's an early sockeye escapement compared to the last 10 years. 15,312 fish have gone up through the 9th of June. Fishing might not or cannot occur before the expected 40,000 fish go through the weir, which they estimate will roughly happen around the 15th of June at the current trend. They are saying that they will allow for a 48-hour opener once the 40,000 fish escapement has gone up the weir at the 15th. They are estimating at this point. So hopefully a 48-hour opener coming in the next week or so. They are estimating over at Chignik to test the total run strength and fleet strength. But of course, this is all speculative at this point. So they are starting to update us that they are looking to have an opener here once 40,000 fish escapement has been reached. Everything's been confidential due to the low amount of deliveries for fish, so no new harvest summaries. And so that will do it here for KSDP for the fish report for June 10th, 2025. This is Austin Roof, and have a great day.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. In Montana, the FBI and Crow Tribe are working together to offer $10,000 for information on the disappearance of Suede Burden Ground, a teenage girl who's been missing from the Crow Reservation for 8 months. YPR's Jackie Coffin has more from Crow Agency.
For its third consecutive year, the FBI has surged resources to its bureaus that serve Indian Country as part of Operation Not Forgotten, an effort in part to investigate cases of missing and murdered Indigenous people. This year's effort will see increased personnel working out of the Billings Field Office covering the nearby Crow and Northern Cheyenne tribal nations. For the Crow tribe, the surge means a flow of badly needed resources to look for missing people, including 13-year-old Suede Burden Ground, who was last seen by her family in Gary Owen on October 6th. Her father, Wade Burden Ground, remembers the last words he heard from her.
It was a Sunday. I was in Billings, and I was out. It was kind of late, and she called me, telling me, you know, good night, I love you, and she always checks on me, you know.
On Friday, FBI agents from the Salt Lake City Bureau, which covers Montana, joined Suede's family, friends, and local and tribal leadership in law enforcement in Crow Agency to announce new resources in the search for Suede. FBI Special Agent in Charge, Maytab Syed.
The FBI is offering a $5,000 reward for information that leads to her recovery.
Crow Tribal Chairman Frank Whiteclay announced the tribe would match the money. Together, FBI agents and tribal members carried red balloons on a walk around the Little Bighorn College to honor Suede. And with her father, Wade, holding on to hope, the reward brings her home.
I love you. I know you're out there. I'm not giving up.
In Crow Agency, I'm Jackie Coffin.
This week, tribal leaders from across the country are gathered on the homeland of the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation in Connecticut for the National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Convention. Leaders are addressing top issues facing their communities and advancing tribal priorities for NCEI to advocate on their behalf. Monday's agenda included a discussion about the Indian Health Service, violence against women, and Native education. Among concerns of attendees are recent actions by the Trump administration, including possible funding cuts to federal programs and services for tribes. Rodney Butler, chairman of the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation, says of the NCAI gathering as a place to interact with government officials, fellow tribal leaders, and other stakeholders in Indian country. He adds that indigenous people are resilient and have been through many tough times.
We are born out of perseverance, and we will get beyond these moments, right? That's the most important thing in sharing in that. But also recognizing that there are some opportunities even in the clouds that we're seeing. And so the interim Assistant Secretary of Interior will be here, Scott Davis, and he's going to talk a lot about what tribes can do with this administration and, you know, in advancing sovereignty, in growing our tribal economies, and other areas where their priorities do overlap, not perfectly with ours, but there's certainly opportunity in there. And so that's a lot of what we're talking about, and just sharing, you know, the war stories of, you know, how did you navigate this scenario with your grant reductions and what's the best path forward? And you see a lot of that. And that's the beauty of NCI, broadly speaking, is just being able to share those experiences with sister tribal nations, and we all learn from each other.
Tuesday's agenda includes conversations about Native child and family well-being, Indigenous determinants of health, and NCAI Native American Rights Fund priorities. The NCAI Convention and Marketplace continues through Wednesday. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
I have great concerns with what we've seen unfold in L.A.
Senator Murkowski criticizes the Trump administration's deployment of Marines to Los Angeles. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Anchorage's largest homeless camp is set to be cleared, but some residents are hesitant to leave.
I got a crap load of family in town, but this is my family here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Alaska's U.S. senators are split over President Trump's decision to send Marines to Los Angeles in response to protests there, some of them violent. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says the U.S. military should not be mobilized against Americans.
Our laws say exactly that. Our military are to be used to protect us from foreign threats, but not within our own country.
California officials have asked a judge to restrict the troops to just guarding federal properties and not exercising police powers. Murkowski says even if that's all the Marines are doing, the appearance is still not good. And she says the violence among some of the protesters is terrible too.
It needs to be condemned at every level, but there are ways that the government responds, and most notably by the state initially. So I have great concerns with what we've seen unfold in L.A.
Murkowski is one of the few Republican senators willing to publicly criticize some of Trump's actions, so she and Senator Dan Sullivan split on a wide range of issues. Sullivan declined to take a question when asked in a Senate hallway.
Talk to me about the Marine deployments.
Sorry.
In Los Angeles? No?
Sullivan's office, though, issued a statement noting that the protesters have destroyed property and attacked law enforcement officers, including agents trying to enforce immigration laws. Sullivan's statement goes on to say, quote, "The senator believes it is appropriate and lawful to deploy the National Guard and the Marines to protect federal law enforcement officers and federal property." Alaska Congressman Nick Begich's office did not immediately respond to an emailed question on the subject. Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The two largest homeless camps in Anchorage are scheduled to be cleared out in a week. Mayor Suzanne LaFrance says the city is doing lots of outreach to get people into shelters and housing before then, but some campers are not interested. Alaska Public Media's Hannah Floor talked to two friends who don't want to leave their tight-knit community at Mountain View Snow Dump.
Lucille Williams has a full-length mirror in her tent, propped up against a clothing rack.
I was trying to keep myself up, like trying to do my hair, do my nails.
Says she's always been that way. It didn't change when she became homeless, but other things did.
I used to be really freaking bitter and angry all the time.
She says she's softened since living in the camp. She's slowly discovered she's a people person. She credits the change to her friends, like Brian Vaughn. He's sitting cross-legged on the carpeted floor of her tent, trying to remember just how long they've known each other.
God, what's it been, 7 years? 8 years? We've been doing this? Holy crap, yeah.
They've both been living in the Mountain View Snow Dump about 3 years. It's one of the largest camps in Anchorage. But now they have to figure out what to do next. They can't stay. None of the campers can. The city is officially clearing the area on June 17th. City officials say they're trying to move people into shelter beds and other housing before then. But Vaughn and Williams say those officials are missing the point. Their relationships are more important to them than housing. They don't want to be split up.
It's comfortable here. It makes me feel like I'm okay. Like, I'm actually, like, a lot more okay now.
Vaughn and Williams' tents are about 30 feet apart, part of the whole big cluster. Vaughn has been homeless since he got out of jail about a decade ago. Williams doesn't want to talk about the details of what happened with her. She just says at the time she was trying to be stubborn. She's sitting on her twin bed, a stack of foam pads. She leans over to the nightstand and picks up a framed pencil sketch of an older man. Her dad, she says. He died of cancer 3 years ago this October. He'd come out to the snow dump to visit her, bring food and propane. William says she managed to make it to his medical appointments. That was Vaughn's doing.
He was on top of it before I was even trying to figure it out. He already had it figured out.
And she says Vaughn was there for her after he died.
The hardest thing that ever happened, like, and he always made sure that, you know, that everything was good, and I always made sure everything was going to be okay.
She says those close friendships make life easier, sometimes even better than before she lost her housing. She says she still struggles with depression, and she likes to drink. For the first time in her life, she feels like people understand her. Everyone around her has gone through something similar, so she doesn't feel judged.
I mean, like, I got a crap load of family in town, but this is my family here. And I wouldn't trade nobody in. Well, maybe a couple people. No, I'm joking. But this is my family.
Like a family, they help each other, chopping firewood, cooking meals, giving advice, getting through Anchorage's winters. Vaughn and Williams remember a time when it was 15 below. 20 people were crammed into a tent trying to stay warm.
Three of them just hate each other, and it's like you got to convince them that, hey, if you don't like each other, you just don't have to talk to each other. It's that simple. I mean.
And then they grow on you, and like you can't live without them after that.
The LaFrance administration says they're prioritizing getting campers into shelters and housing in groups so they don't have to leave their friends and family. But William says their group is too big.
We talked about, like, if we had a choice, who would we bring? Like, but we can't leave anybody out. So we're trying to figure out, like, what to do.
Vaughn is the unofficial leader of the group, so people are looking to him to figure out what comes next.
I've got a lot of people just counting on me to make the right decision, and I'm scared I'm going to make the wrong one.
I don't think he can make the wrong one because everybody looks up to him. And even if it were the wrong one, we can have his back and we can be right there with him.
William says no matter what, they'll stick together. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Floor.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, thousands of photos taken by a Thlinget elder from Angoon may hold distant memories.
If people walk away seeing these photos and they feel like he gave them that one moment in time back, that makes me happy.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It doesn't matter what you were wearing, what you were drinking, or what you agreed to in the past. Sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through multiple resources. Visit notaloneak.org to find help for yourself or a loved one. Remember, it's not your fault. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
An employee of an Anchorage hotel was fatally stabbed last weekend after police say he and the suspect got into a dispute. Police say they arrested 27-year-old Matthew Alexi yesterday. He's charged with second-degree murder and evidence tampering in the death of 25-year-old Michael Caskey. According to charges against Alexi, police were called at about 10:30 p.m. Saturday to the Chelsea Inn located in Spinard. A witness told police that Caskey had been posted outside the inn and ordered to collect $20 from anyone entering the building. The witness said Alexi's girlfriend tried to slip past Caskey, but he stopped her. That led to Alexi and Caskey getting into a shoving match. Police say Alexi stabbed Caskey in the stomach. Responding officers found Caskey alive, but he died at the scene. Police say surveillance video from the inn showed Alexi and his girlfriend leaving in an SUV. Caskey is not the inn's first employee to die on the job. Police say that in 2020, Dwayne Fields was shot to death as he tried to protect a woman from being beaten. Alexi is being held today at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. An Alaska Railroad locomotive leaked about 900 gallons of diesel fuel early Friday morning after it derailed in an area north of Talkeetna. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
None of the three railroad employees aboard the work train reported injuries, according to an Alaska Railroad news release. Two locomotives were part of the work train that was doing maintenance on the tracks before it derailed just after 3 a.m. Friday. But both were back on the tracks by Friday night. One of the locomotives sustained damage when its 2,600-gallon fuel tank was punctured and leaked after it derailed. An Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation news release estimates somewhere between 800 and 1,000 gallons of diesel leaked. The railroad says the damaged locomotive remains on site at the Curry Loop track. The other engine and cars in the work train are back in Anchorage. DEC says railroad workers laid down absorbent material to soak up fuel and built berms to contain it. A DEC contractor excavated about 500 cubic yards of contaminated soil by Sunday night and collected 86 bags of fuel-soaked absorbent, according to the release. DEC says the cause of the accident is unknown, and an investigation is ongoing. For KUAC News, I'm Tim Ellis.
Researchers say it's clear that wolves in parts of southeast Alaska are increasingly turning to the sea instead of the land for food. But now there's evidence that the behavior can have toxic results. As Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, the finding has implications for the apex predator and other species across Southeast.
Gretchen Roffler is a wildlife research biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. In 2020, she was studying wolf predation patterns in Southeast, including on Pleasant Island, near Gustavus. A wolf pack in recent years had taken over the island, decimated the local deer population, and started feeding on sea otters instead. The finding at the time underscored coastal wolves' adaptability amid environmental change. But then one died. Roffler explained the situation on a hike during a recent visit to Haines, where she owns property and sits on the board of a local trails nonprofit.
And we found her in a hole under a tree. She had lost about a third of her body weight. She was emaciated. And we were trying to understand the causes of her death. And so we sent
a series of tests on the animal ruled out a range of diseases, Roffler says. What did show up, though, were elevated levels of mercury attributable to the wolves' marine diets.
And we learned that the mercury concentrations were really high. So they were many orders of magnitude higher than other wolf liver tissues that had been analyzed in other parts of the world. So that was a big red flag.
The finding kicked off a sweeping study that examined the extent to which different wolf packs rely on marine prey for food and how that diet might affect their long-term health. It also weighs whether glacier loss, which is accelerating with climate change, could be exacerbating the issue. The researchers looked at a handful of areas, including Pleasant Island, where wolves are now largely eating sea otters instead of deer. They also looked at the Gustavus mainland, where wolves mostly eat terrestrial animals, but are increasingly relying on marine prey. In a paper published earlier this month, they concluded that the wolves' increasingly marine-heavy diets are exposing them to higher mercury levels, which can be toxic. Roffler says submercury is not uncommon in predators with marine diets, like fox and polar bears.
So we know that this happens. The thing that was unusual in our study was the severe mercury concentrations in these wolf tissues, such that
the study has implications for wolves and other species beyond that one area. That's the case particularly as sea otters proliferate along Alaska's coasts. The species was hunted to local extinction during the fur trade in the 1800s. But then, in the 1960s, the state reintroduced them to the region. The marine predator is now common around areas like Glacier Bay National Park.
We can assume that as sea otters continue to recolonize parts of their former range and grow in numbers, that wolves and other terrestrial predators will start using them as prey.
Ben Barst is an assistant professor at the University of Calgary who studies ecotoxicology. He co-authored the report. Barst says mercury ends up in the ocean in a few ways. First, humans release it into the atmosphere via activities like coal combustion and gold mining. But in Southeast specifically, there's another potential source, glacier runoff, which holds mercury and is increasing with climate change. Once mercury enters an aquatic environment, Barst says, it easily contaminates living organisms like mussels, clams, and sea urchins, and then makes its way up the food chain. So by the time a sea otter becomes wolf prey, they can deliver a big dose to the apex predator.
We see this in other instances with fish. You know, small fish are getting eaten by larger fish, which are getting eaten by the biggest fish, and they tend to have the highest mercury concentrations in these larger, older predatory fish.
Barst says the researchers initially assumed that high concentrations of mercury in wolves could be unique to the Gustavus and Pleasant Island area. More research is needed to determine whether that's the case. There's uncertainty regarding the contribution of glaciers and how wolf diets might flex over time. But it's increasingly clear that wolves across Southeast are tapping into marine food webs, Barst says, which means it's possible the trend could play out elsewhere. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare. Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member.
From natural gas to geothermal to hydro and solar energy, there was an array of possibilities presented last week at the Alaska Sustainable Energy Conference. All of them need a gray and greasy mineral called graphite to turn raw energy into power. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, one company says it's a step closer to mining it in Alaska.
If Anthony Houston has his way, in 3 years' time, he'll be selling graphite from a mine near Nome.
We have the largest graphite deposit, not just in the United States, but one of the largest in the world.
Houston is the owner of Graphite One. Although his mine hasn't been developed yet, his company is already marketing the mineral.
What we're working on right now is something that's never been done before.
Houston has partnered with Lucid Motors, a company that makes luxury electric vehicles at a plant in Arizona.
So there's never been a graphite asset being produced in the United States and selling to another American company making their automobiles here in the United States.
It's a deal Houston announced at the conference, along with the CEO of Lucid Motors, Mark Winterhoff.
We're a truly American EV manufacturer. Our cars are designed and engineered in California, and they're all built in Arizona in our plant in Casa Grande.
Lucid Motors already has an agreement with Graphite One to buy the synthetic graphite that the company markets. The Alaska deal now gives them a supply of natural graphite, also important to battery performance and cheaper to produce. Winterhoff says graphite overall, synthetic or natural, is in short supply, and its production is dominated by the Chinese, who are positioning themselves to take over the global EV market.
The Chinese automotive industry has not been sleeping the last 15 years. It's really actually incredible what kind of quality and functionality those vehicles currently have.
Lucid Motors says it's a win-win for the car maker to secure a supply of Alaska graphite, a commitment that will help Graphite One finance its mine, and ultimately, says Governor Mike Dunleavy, create new opportunities.
So this particular mine will employ folks most likely from Nome and surrounding areas, high-paying jobs. This play, by some estimates, is multi-generational, 100 years plus.
Beyond the graphite, Lucid Motors has another Alaska connection. At Fort Greeley, they've been testing their cars to see how they perform in cold weather. Outside the Denina Convention Center, Winterhoff showed off Lucid's new SUV model called Gravity. He says it can go 450 miles without a charge, enough to get from Anchorage to Fairbanks.
Basically, the whole length of the car between the axles is filled with batteries.
The luxury sedan, the Lucid Air, has a range of more than 500 miles. Winterhoff says EVs are constantly evolving.
Think about it like your phone. Every other, actually, day these days, you get an update, you press the button, and your phone is kind of new. Yeah? And that's the same with our car as well.
The Gravity SUV starts at around $95,000, but the company hopes to get its next version down to under $80,000. Although Graphite One is on the fast track for federal permitting for its Graphite Creek mine, those who hunt and fish on the land and waters that surround it worry about the trade-offs. Graphite One says the Bering Straits Native Corporation has invested in its company, and there's a subsistence advisory committee to help keep communities nearby informed about the project as well as get their feedback. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
The Devil's Thumb Shooters are officially state champions. Petersburg's shooting team took home first place at the 2025 Youth Education in Shooting Sports Championship in Anchorage last week. As KFSK's Taylor Heckert reports, the team had a loud welcome home.
Petersburg's Devil's Thumb Shooters were welcomed home with a noise parade. After landing at the airport, they were met by a crowd of friends and family. Then, fire trucks and cars paraded the team through town. The Devil's Thumb Shooters competed in a variety of events at the tournament, including trap, skeet, and wobble shooting. Trent Kittums recently graduated high school and has been with the club for 8 years. He scored the highest overall on the team and says a win like this is a big deal for the group.
That was the first time our club actually won that, which is pretty sweet to go out on for my senior year.
Junior Tyson Reed has only been with the team for 2 seasons, but he hit a big milestone this week.
I did shoot 25 straight. That would be a perfect round without a single miss. So then I threw my hat in the air and the entire legion of people shot at it. And yeah, it was pretty cool.
Reed was one of 2 members on the team who got a perfect round at the tournament. The athletes worked hard to get to state. Larry O'Rear is the head coach of the team. He says it took a lot of shooting and fundraising to make it this far. So what's next for the Devil's Thumb Shooters?
Well, they're all excited and ready to start shooting again right away.
O'Rear says that the team will take a few months off and will start shooting again in the fall. In Petersburg, I'm Taylor Heckert.
In the basement of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau sit thousands and thousands of photographs. They were taken by a Thlinget elder who has since passed on. But for decades, he documented important events in everyday life. And as KTOO's Yvonne Crumry reports, the organization wants help identifying people and places in the photos.
Kahkahu Cyril George Sr.'s family unearthed his photo collection in the wake of his death 11 years ago. His granddaughter, Lillian Woodbury, said she was astounded at the volume of photos he kept in a small Juneau condo.
That tiny little room had been harboring all of these memories he captured in photo. I mean, every time we thought, we've got them all, we pulled out another box or another container. And I'd be like, oh my God, Mom, it's another box of photos.
To Woodbury, George was grandpa, but he left a mark on thousands of people in Southeast Alaska. George was a Thlinget leader from Angoon who lived to be 92 years old. Videos of his speeches are used for Thlinget language classes, and a collection at the University of Alaska Southeast Library is named after him. A family friend suggested they donate the photographs to Sea Alaska Heritage Institute to preserve and store them.
There's so much just joy in these photos. It's one of my favorite things, looking through them and seeing people just having a good time. People dancing, people talking to each other, cooking out on the beach.
That's Emily Galgano, one of the archivists who's been combing through the photos for the last several years. Some of the photos are online now and printed in books that are available in Juneau and Angoon for elders to look through. SHI hopes people will recognize some of the faces.
The first thing is we tried to find photos where you could see people's faces clearly, because the point of the book is really to try to get some identifications.
There are 20,000 photos in the full collection. A lot of them are pet photos and landscapes, but of the 1,600 SHI has made available, most are of people. Dancers in full regalia, fishing trips with strung up halibut, graduations and meetings. The photos are full of life. Basketball games and 4th of July parades. They show Thlinget people living, working, teaching, and making art. They show elders and babies, and elders with babies. And those babies may be elders now themselves. Thlinget photographer Brian Wallace helped SHI scan the photographs. He knew George growing up, and looking through the photos, he was surprised by how many there are of everyday life.
They seemed mundane at the time, but looking back into the whole scope of things, it's just an amazing body of work.
Wallace says the photos of Kuik and early celebrations stand out to him, that they show how Southeast Alaska Native cultures have endured.
You know, they were thriving back then. They were thriving when he took the photos and still thriving.
And some of the photos were deeply personal for Wallace.
And then I loved finding the photographs that he had of my parents, to see some of those photos. And then also lots of photos of my aunts, you know, of my aunties cooking dinner or singing songs or just in the background of photos. It was always fun to see those.
Woodbury, George's granddaughter, says it was hard to part with the collection. The memory of his loss is still fresh, more than a decade later.
But we also didn't want a lifetime of him making sure he carried that camera around to be lost.
She hopes that others, like Wallace, will look through the collection and find photos of loved ones who've passed on.
I think if people walk away seeing these photos and they feel like he gave them that one moment in time back, that makes me happy. And that will be a small part of this.
Another part of his legacy is Woodbury herself. She's a photographer, too.
I think I was 16 the first time he gifted me a camera. And that was all it took.
And you can find a link to the photo collection in the online version of this story at ktoo.org. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumery.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Hannah Floor, Chris Clint, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Avery Elfeld in Haines, Taylor Heckert in Petersburg, and Yvonne Crumery in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Gonna feel like hell tonight. Tears of rage I cannot buy. I'd be the last to help you understand. Are you strong enough to be my
You are the few, the proud, you are the antibody, mind, soul, and zen. And the world's a stage. The way that you are, it's just the way that you talk, like it ain't no thing. And every single day is just a blink, then the morning comes. Take your knock, shake them off, duck everybody. The way that you are, it's just the way that you talk, like it ain't no thing. And every single day is just a blink. And when it comes, it moves so slow, kinda like it's saying, I told you so. Looking back before she goes, tomorrow's gone.
To live, I want to die.
on the moon, and I make the seven wonders too. There's nothing that I cannot do, 'cause I am human. There is nothing that I cannot be. I'm the one who set the seven seas, and I know that it is all in me, 'cause I am human.
Oh,
myself?
No, no.
Can you please tie me up a little bit more?
I was a little different. I didn't do what the best girls do. Study my rhythm. Now you can speed me up when you want to. First the sun and the moon introduced the sun and the chair goes cat and told the mound. Once we met, we will never lose. Oh boy. I decided that you are the real for me. I decided.
Oh boy. The chair was got so the mound. Once we met, we were never.